morning.
Thanks for having me today. Not that you had a choice. But thank you for trusting her to have me come in and just talk to you today. And so I'm just going to tell you about my story, and then in the midst of that, hoping that you can relate in some way. And really my goal is to just kind of instill some hope in you. So I believe that there's freedom to be had for everyone, no matter what your issue is. And so my goal is to help you to see that there is hope and there is freedom that's possible. So my husband laughs at me because I'm not like the most organized of all people, which is funny. I actually do that for a living. I work part-time for a family, and I literally organize their house and pick up, and like, it's awesome. I love it. But at home, I'm not really that. So at home, on my side of the bed, there's always some pile of clothing. Thankfully, it's on the opposite side of the door, so you can't actually see it when you walk by. But we have a small house, and so if anything's on the floor, people just kind of, you step over it or it's in the way. So we have to try to clean up a little bit. But my pile of clothes is just one thing I struggle with all the time. And I'm always in a hurry. Like, I'm sure you know, as a mom, you're always in a hurry to get undressed. There's either a kid calling you or a dinner to be made, or I'm exhausted and I want to get my pajamas as fast as possible and I'm not going to put my clothes away. So this pile just kind of builds, and my husband has affectionately called her Sally. She has a name. And when she gets big enough, she has a party, and she invites Susie and Bob. And so it's funny. That's kind of like this running joke between us. But what will happen will be, after a while, I feel bad enough that this big pile of clothing has accumulated. And if I don't have time to put it away, then I pick it up, and I have this big armoire that I keep on my foot, and I shove it in the armoire, and then I shut the door, and hope that it doesn't fall out as I'm trying to shut the door. And then, you know, it's like, oh, I need a t-shirt. So I open it up and then all these clothes fall out and I pick it up and throw it back in until the day when I finally get to take it all out, refold it, rearrange it, and put it back and we're good. But as I was doing that one day, I was like, isn't this a metaphor for life? Like, you've got a mess. Some people see it. Some people are annoyed by it. And so what do? You pick it all up, and you try to shove it, and then hurry and close the doors so that no one's going to see it. And it's like you try to put on your best yoga pants that don't have either, like, kid snot and graham crackers or paint or something on. You wear your best yoga pants in hopes, you know, that people will notice that, you know, you've tried to put yourself together, or you try to put makeup on for your husband. He doesn't even recognize you. Or maybe, like, you have a finely manicured, like, family. Maybe on the outside it looks like everything's great and your kids put the Duggars to shame. And, you know, like, your marriage is just one that they would want a reality show about. And on the inside, you may just be, like, going off the rails with resentment, bitterness, anger, frustration, shame. And I think that, like my armor, a lot of times that's what happens, is we are so full of all of this messy stuff. And one little thing could happen. Our kid could misbehave. Our husband could look at us the wrong way. A friend could offend us. And all of a sudden, those doors fly open and we just throw up all of that anger and bitterness and shame and frustration at whoever might be the closest victim. Until the next time, we close the door, put everything back, make it look all good, make it look like we're good on the outside. And this was me for so long. On the outside, I looked like I had it all together. I married my high school sweetheart. We had two beautiful girls. They're 16 and 14 now. So they are full-on teenagers, and I don't know if you guys have teenagers, but I actually love it. So if you don't have teenagers yet, don't believe all those lies that people say, oh, teenagers. Like, I love my teenagers. They're awesome. But But, you know, I was working in ministry, I was involved in church, I was doing all these, like, great things for God, and not to mention, I had thin privilege. Like, I was just naturally thin all of my life. And so it looked like I had everything together, but what people didn't see was, like, the inside of my armoire. It was just full of shame and guilt and frustration and resentment and bitterness and all of these things that I had stuffed down for so long. What people didn't know was that for 20 plus years, I had been battling an eating disorder. And to the world, it didn't look like I had an eating disorder, because what is socially acceptable is rigid diet, restricted eating, over-exercising. It's encouraged. The medical community will tell you that. Any form of media will tell you that. Famous people will tell you that. Your friends will tell you that. I've heard pastors over and over refer to things such as dieting and losing weight. So it's the church community as well is infected. It's not just a secular thing. But the lies that we have been told, like how it had just infected me. And so it didn't look like that, because I was just doing what I had been trained to do all my life. I was just following the rules that had been taught to me. And so I'm the youngest of eight kids, and my mom, I mean, God bless her, she's an amazing woman. She's 81 now.
Wow.
She still goes to Weight Watchers every week and gets weighed in at 81, and
that's
has been doing
wow.
that for how many years? But dieting was just a part of our family all of my life. I have four sisters, my mom, my grandma, everyone was always dieting, even my dad. And then they would get into these, you know, like direct sales, network marketing companies that were supposed to promise the moon, where you drink one shake and that's supposed to fill you for the day. And so here I am as a growing girl, already believing the lies that I'm not supposed to feel hungry. I'm not supposed to eat more than a granola bar, a meal replacement bar. I had already begun to believe the lies that I only had value in my body size and in my shape. And I remember laying on my mom and dad's bed and watching my mom get dressed most mornings and just standing there listening to her. And she, at this point, she's younger than I am now. Like, she was younger. And so, I mean, guys, this is like, I mean, we're talking about at least 60 years, if not more, of this battle. But I remember laying there and just watching her get dressed and always complaining about, oh, I'm so fat, if I could just lose this belly. And she'd grab her tummy, or, you know, and she'd just look at every square inch of herself in the mirror. And she would just constantly, negatively put herself down about how fat she was. And so at a young age, that became my definition. I knew that if my mom said that was negative, I didn't want to look like that, because that was bad. What she looks like was bad. And so in my mind, that became the definition of fat, because that's what I heard all the time. And so growing up, I was just naturally thin. I was a gymnast, and I was in this environment where you were better if you were thin. And so as I got into my teenage years and you start putting on some weight, naturally you're supposed to, you start going through puberty like you're supposed to, and all of a sudden I wasn't as thin as I was before, and it was like these loud sirens were going off in my head, like, stop, 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 do something, you're gonna end up like your mom. And I was like, oh no, I will not end up like my mom, she is fat. And that was what is going on in my head. And that sounds really awful. My mom was not 400 pounds. Like, she was a normal average woman, but in my mind, I had already decided I would not look like that. And so thus began a very long disordered relationship with myself, of where I viewed my identity and my value, what I thought was acceptable, and then also a very disordered relationship with food. As a side note, I met my husband at 15, and if you know any 15-year-old boys, your husband was one of them at one point, they're very visually charged. So he made a lot of positive comments about my body, you know, as we were dating and growing up, because that was what he liked. Like, visually, he liked that. And so I got complimented a lot for that. From him, I knew, oh, he likes it. He likes me being thin. He likes me working out and having muscles. And not to mention, like, just being small in my friend group. I just got a lot of comments. Like I said, I was the youngest of 8 kids, so I didn't get a lot of attention because there was always some crisis. We owned our family business. There was a crisis going on. Jonna was left at gymnastics practice. She was left at the school. Like, oh, sorry, hon, we forgot to pay your school bill. You know, it's like, okay, thanks. So all that to say, like, any attention to me was good attention. And so if people were commenting about, oh, you're so skinny, how do you do? I wish I were that skinny. I wish I were that thin. Like, I ate that up. I ate that up, and that became my identity. So I went to IU and realized I wasn't the thinnest girl on the block anymore. There are a lot of thin people in this world. I wasn't the big fish in the small pond. And I joined a sorority, and then that just, wow, blows it out of the water. Everybody there was trying to be thin and comparing one another. And so it was when I was at IU that I was like, I got to do something or else I'm going to gain that freshman 15 that everyone's been telling me I'm going to gain, and I'm not going to do that. So that was really when I began restricting my food and becoming very obsessive with exercise. And I don't know if you guys remember, but like the Snackwells cookies that were like fat-free. You could eat 2 boxes of fat-free Snackwells, and you feel like crap afterwards, but they were fat-free, you know. Or like fat-free Cool Whip with fat-free cream cheese and fat-free pudding makes a great pie. Like, oh my gosh, it was tasteless. My most favorite memory of this time in my life is we were standing on the in the front lawn of my husband's fraternity, and here comes this big van. Whoever makes Doritos, I don't know who it is, the company that makes Doritos, comes driving by in their big van, and they're throwing fat-free Doritos out the van. Do you guys remember those?
Yes.
They were fat-free Doritos made with this chemical called Olestra.
Yeah.
And it would give you diarrhea for days. Because it was some chemical that literally, they said it would not cling to fat cells or something. So it literally just like would run through you. So I'm like, give me all the Olestra and fat-free Doritos I can get. And that would become my fuel. And I mean, again, I'm in the bathroom. I didn't get what I ate was fat-free, you know. And so, fast forward a little bit through the years, got married, had kids, been married now for a while, and by this point, I've really had a lot of time to digest the things that culture has told me, and I believe them. Talking about the Enneagram, I am a 1, and so you tell me something, I'm going to follow that rule to a T because you have promised me this in the result. And so whatever society told me, whatever commercials I saw, whatever program was promised to me, I was going to do it. And so some of the things that I had begun to tell myself, some of you may be able to relate to some of these things. I believed I needed to count my calories or my carbs or my sugar. Now it's counting macros is the popular trendy thing. I believed I needed to count calories in order to keep my willpower in check. I believed that I needed to shop at Earth Fair or Fresh Time and only eat organic in order to be considered healthy and make myself a better person. I believed that if I would just cut back on food before a wedding or a big event or vacation, you know, spring break bod. Gosh, I heard that like 80 times last night. If only I would cut back, you know, months prior to, then I would have that perfect body for vacation or the wedding that I was looking for. I believed that if I would drink enough water or coffee, then I would fight off that hunger and then I wouldn't have to eat. I believed that if I went gluten-free or paleo, that I could do that in the name of health. But I really wasn't trying to lose weight, but I was doing it because I wanted to be healthy. I believed that bread was bad, dairy was bad, processed food was bad. Everything but fresh vegetables and plain lean chicken with no sauce or dressing, only salt and pepper, was bad. I believed that my emotional well-being was in direct correlation to whatever I ate or however I had exercise that day. I believed that there was a list of good food and there was a list of bad food, and you should stick to it or else you will be punished. I believed that I needed to allow the scale to determine how much food I was going to eat that day, or I needed to allow the exercise thing that told me how many calories I had burned to determine what I would eat. I believe that I didn't have enough self-control to stick to a diet. I believe that I was a failure because I wasn't able to do Whole 30. I thought that hunger was a sign of weakness. I thought that eating less meant that I was getting healthier. I thought that losing weight was something to be congratulated on, and that gaining weight was something to be ashamed of. And in the end, I always thought, it's okay, I'll get back on track Monday. And those are some of the things that, through the years, kept me just in a prison, honestly. Frustrated, feeling guilty all the time, feeling ashamed all the time, feeling like I was doing life, but up here, there was something else going on in my head. I spent my days constantly, even, you know, with young children at my feet, like, I was constantly thinking about what I ate, what I didn't eat, what I will eat, what I won't eat, what I should eat, how I'm going to change my exercise plan, why I didn't change my exercise plan. It was this constant dialogue in my head of I should, shouldn't, do, don't, blah, blah, blah. And it was exhausting. But that's what diet culture is. That's what we, like I said, that's what we've been trained to believe for so long. And I think that we don't know to challenge that. And that's one thing I want you guys to get from today, is I want to challenge you to think about what you've been told. And I want you to challenge when culture tells you something, whether or not it's the truth. Because the diet and fitness industry is an $80 billion industry. And the only reason they're making that much money is because people like you and me keep buying into it, looking for hope in that next diet or that next exercise plan or that next pill or that next saran wrap that goes around your belly. Like, that's why they keep making so much money. 95% of women regularly diet. 95%. And I'm sure each and every one of you can relate to, at some point in your life, being on a diet, you lost a little bit of weight, you're feeling good about yourself, somebody compliments, oh, you look great, you lost weight, I have. Give it about 2 months, guess what? 95% of diets fail. Oh, you have a 1 in 5 chance of actually keeping the weight off. So think about that. Would you buy a car if it had a 95% failure rate? Would you buy a TV if it had a 95% failure rate? No. But yet we keep buying a product and an ideal that has a 95% failure rate. We know it's not going to work. Science has proved it. Yet we still keep doing it. And because we keep doing it and we keep failing at it, and then we gain the weight back, and you feel guilty and you feel ashamed, and so you're just going to try harder next time. I'll get more self-control. And you try it again. Guess what? It's actually harder to lose weight the second time. Because your body goes into protective mode. Your metabolism is decreased because it's in protection mode. You actually don't lose weight as easily as it was the first time. You might actually gain weight this time.
Now where are you? You're deeper in that hole, right? You're deeper in feeling like you're a failure because you can't even stick to a freaking diet. All I don't want to do is eat bread and dairy. Is it that hard? Yes, actually it is very hard. And it's not worth it. So we find ourselves in this vicious cycle of diets and exercise and this pursuit of weight loss. 1 in 4 women will end up in a full-fledged eating disorder just based off of dieting. So no one intends on going to an eating disorder. I did not intend that when I was a freshman in college in my dorm, and I'm like, I'm just going to eat a bagel, one bagel all day long. I didn't know that that was going to lead to falling asleep in class, my whole body being had consequences of it, metabolism and everything. I didn't know that. I didn't intend on that. Just like maybe you, 1 in 4. I mean, look at the statistics. A diet will most likely lead to some form of an eating disorder. If not, it leads to very disordered eating, which is just a poor relationship with food and with your body. And that's scary. When you think about it, if any of you have girls, that's a scary statistic. My girls are old enough now. They come home. They tell me what everybody eats at the table, who doesn't eat, why they're not eating. And they know. They're like, Mom, all Katie ate was a muffin today. And I'm like, you know what I know about Katie? I know Katie goes home after school and binges because she's starving. She told me that. And she's like, well, she makes all of us think that she doesn't eat anything. And I was like, why do you think she's gained weight? She's like, oh, that makes you gain weight? Yeah, that actually makes you gain weight. And so I want you guys to know some of these practical things. So I want to take kind of what diet industry has told us and these lies we believe, and I want to counteract them with what actually is the truth. And the first thing is that dieting actually makes you gain weight. Because when you think about binging, how many, I don't want to see a show of hands, but think about it. Do you think, oh, I can never just. Yeah, whatever. You don't even know what I'm saying. Oh my gosh, that's exact. That's the example everyone uses.
And the Jenny ones are the worst.
Thin mints.
Oh, that's
a
good
one. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, so this is a fact. This is scientifically proven. The reason that sometimes we feel like we're out of control around food, or you might call yourself a food addict, or I just have an addiction to sweets. I have an addiction to carbs. I need to not eat carbs for a month because I'm addicted to them. The reason you feel that way is because you have restricted them. A binge is a direct result of some form of restriction. If you're not restricting, you won't binge. So when you tell yourself, these foods are forbidden, I can't eat this, I can't eat that, if they have proven with brain stuff, I don't know, I'm not a scientist, even though it's a biology major, whatever. They have proven that even the thought of breaking a forbidden food rule will cause you to overeat and to binge. Just the thought of breaking it. So if you think about what you restrict for you personally, if there's something you're like, oh, I can't have that, is it any wonder that when you get in the presence of that food, you're like, give it all to me. I will eat it all. Oh, I'll get back on check Monday. I'll get back on the wagon Monday. Guess what? There's no wagon to get on. There's no wagon to fall off of. There's no wagon. If you have no wagon to get on or off of, you can just live life freely eating as your body tells you to eat. And you may be thinking, if I just ate whatever I wanted, I'm just going to be out of control. You know, and I'll eat the whole box of Oreos and the whole box of Thin Mints. Yeah, at first, it is kind of like that. But with time, as you give yourself permission, as you take away the power that food has, as you take away those good and bad food rules of the food police, as you take that away, that desire actually just kind of wanes. Because food loses its power. It no longer has control over you. It no longer dictates how you're going to feel about yourself. It no longer dictates what you're going to eat or how much guilt you're going to feel. it's like, oh, a cookie's a cookie. Hmm. That baguette from Panera, just a baguette from Panera. If I want it, I'll eat it. If I don't, I don't. And, like, that's the beauty of it. That is the beauty. And I brought this book with me. It's called Intuitive Eating. Highly recommend it. Highly recommend it. It talks about this idea of intuitive eating, which is the way that God created your bodies to actually eat. Like, as a baby, you don't... A baby doesn't have to be told when to eat, when to be hungry. A baby doesn't have to be told what to eat, what not to eat. A baby just... When they're hungry, they cry. I want food. Feed me. When they're full, they go. So it's honoring your hunger and fullness cues. That's what intuitive eating is. And so I really encourage you to read that book because it dives a whole lot deeper into all of the stuff that I've talked about today that I don't have time for. So a couple other like things that I want you to know that actually are true is eating disorders don't always look the same. That an eating disorder doesn't just mean it looks like that girl that you saw on the ABC After School Special growing up as a kid that I was obsessed with, which now makes a lot of sense. It's not just this really thin girl. It could be someone that is in a larger body, smaller body. You may equate a small body with health. They may be super unhealthy. You may equate a large body with unhealthy. That person may actually be very healthy. So I think we have been so trained in culture to look at a person's body and judge what kind of life they're leading and if they're unhealthy. And we look at a large person and we're like, oh, they've really let themselves go. They really gave up on life. Actually, that's not true. And I hate that saying. I used it for years. Like, I'm dogging myself because, and I just used the word dogging, but that's funny. My husband would laugh at me. I'm coming down on myself, too, because I used that phrase for so long. Oh, she just let herself go. Oh, she's so out of shape. Or I need to get in shape. Guess what? Here's another truth. There's no shape to get into. You don't have a mold that you have to fit. Every single one of you is uniquely created. And so you're just supposed to be the exact mold that God created you to be. You don't have to try to fit into somebody at the CrossFit gyms. Their mold. Or somebody at LA. Or somebody that you see on TV. The Kardashians are not like our standard. Let's not try to look like them.
And they made big butts in. Which
I
think fascinating.
Right.
Like,
what is that? I know.
Like,
that's
cool.
Crazy.
Like, girls are trying to make their butts big.
Yeah. Yeah. Booty pop. They have booty pop shorts. Yeah. Yeah. So, here's the other thing. What'd you say?
I said, but some of you don't have big butts. And that's okay,
exactly.
Too.
Exactly. I will never forget the time one of my friends, she gave me some of her clothes, and she gave me the skirt. She goes, it'll look so much cuter on you. You have a bigger butt than I do. Thank you.
Yeah. No, it's not a compliment.
And,
no,
I mean,
no,
this was 10 years ago, so she had no idea I was in this, like, deep, dark place. What did that do? That drove me to restrict even more. Guess what? My butt didn't get smaller. It just didn't. So those are some of the truths. There isn't a shape you have to be in. Certain shapes don't mean health. You can't actually gain 10 pounds in one day on Christmas or Thanksgiving. It's not physiologically possible. You can't do it. So when you say, oh, I gained 10 pounds on that cruise, you didn't. Which it might be water weight, like scale might tell you different, but you can't gain 10 pounds. And on that, the scale, it's not your identifier of worth and value. I always tell people, throw the scale out. Get rid of it. Like, the reality is, it doesn't tell you anything. It's just a number. So why do we chain ourselves to it? I mean, like I said, my mom, still at 81, she was talking last week about how she had to go to the doctor, and she's still trying to get these last 10 pounds up. I'm like, last 10 pounds? I'm 43, Mom. Your last baby was 43 years ago. You're not still trying to get baby weight off, okay? Another thing, you hear a lot of talk about, like, I just want to get my pre-baby body back. I just want to lose this baby weight. Pre-baby body, you're supposed to have a different body. That's the way God created you. It's supposed to be different. You had a baby. Things change. Things move. And that's okay. I think we shame ourselves and we shame others and we judge others for not being able to lose weight after they have a baby. Who freaking cares? Like, they just had a baby. Let's celebrate the life that they just carried within them and not put ourselves down and put others down for the fact that our hips may be wide and we have to buy new jeans. Another thing my dietitian told me, it's okay to buy new jeans. if your shorts from last summer don't fit or your jeans from last summer don't fit, financially it's not fun. Go out and buy new ones. Get rid of all of the reminders in your closet that are telling you, someday I'm going to fit back in those pants. Someday I'm going to get there. Someday I'll look like that again. Get rid of all those reminders because all they do is send you to a place of shame that you're not who you used to be. You're a failure. You haven't been able to keep the weight off. You can't maintain that. So just get rid of those. Carbs are actually necessary. Don't cut them out. You need them for brain function. Feeling full is actually a part of intuitive eating, and hunger cues are actually a part of eating. I remember always, like, if I was hungry, if I felt hunger pains, I thought it was a sign of weakness, and I'd, like, push them out, like, push the weakness out of the body. Well, actually, we need hunger cues to exist and survive, and so learning, and I will say that has been the hardest process, relearning how to eat, relearning what hunger looks like, relearning what fullness looks like, because what I thought full was, like, eating just enough to kind of settle things off. Like, that's what I thought a full meal was. It was just enough to where I felt a little satisfied. But guess what? I'd be hungry in an hour again because I wasn't eating enough. And if you've noticed, I don't know if you guys know this, but if you, like, basically don't eat much all day long, by about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock, you're starving and you're going to that kitchen and you're going to find whatever you can to get your hands on. And then guess what? You're like, oh, I'm such a fat slob. I need to really start over tomorrow. I just ate the whole kitchen. Well, that's because your body is telling you it needs food. And you didn't eat it all day, and now it needs to make up for it. And so relearning those hunger cues from when you were a baby, relearning what it means to feel hungry and full, these are all things that are part of this whole idea of just, like, debunking the lies the society has told us. Because they tell us, drink a shake, eat a bar, don't give in. Don't get into your hunger, you know? No, actually, eat when you're hungry. You're supposed to. And you know what? There are some days, cyclically, with your hormones and things like that, you're more hungry than others. Or if you've had a more busy day, you're going to be more hungry than others because you've been up longer, for a longer hour. Like, that's just a natural rhythm that our body goes through. So, those are some of the truths that I think are so helpful that I just want to, like, get your brains just kind of thinking on that and to go home. Because once you hear some of these things, you can't unhear them. Like, once you see some of these, like, if you read intuitive eating, once you read that, you can't unread it. And your life is different. You start recognizing in culture the ways that we've been lied to and the things that we've been told, and you start hearing all the diet talk that goes on in your small group, at church, or around your friends and your family, and it will drive you bonkers. Like, it drives me bonkers sometimes. Just last night, again, I was with a bunch of junior high and high school girls, and all they were talking about was their spring break body. I shouldn't be drinking the Starbucks coffee. I'm like, oh my gosh. But I have compassion for them. I was there. I was that girl too. So I have compassion, but yet God wants something better for us. He wants us to not be stuck in this prison. So if those are the lies that culture has told us, there's a reason for it. And for a lot of times, I just thought it was just, those were just the lies, and I kind of stayed there. But in the last, I don't know, couple years, I have really dug a little deeper, and I think it's a deeper issue. I think that we, as society, have been trained to be afraid of fat. phobia. Anybody ever heard that word? people don't really talk about fat phobia, but I think that is the deeper issue. Thinness carries currency in our culture. If you have thin privilege, you really have thin privilege. It carries value. It carries power in the workplace, at home, at church, everywhere. And so culture has told us if thin is more valuable, if thin has power, you need to go after thinness. And so because of that, we all, I can say we all as a society, are on this constant, consistent pursuit of weight loss to avoid fat. And so I'm just going to kind of leave that there and let you guys think about if you yourself are afraid of fat. And I'm going to kind of move in and actually tell you a little bit more of my story. But with that, ask yourself, am I afraid of fat? And if I am, why? Why am I afraid to gain weight or not maintain my weight? Why am I always trying to lose it? So for me, this fear of fat was 100% because that's where I found my value. Like I said, growing up, I always had been thin and had been complimented on that and got all of these comments. And so that really had become my identity, especially dating a 15-year-old boy who I go on to marry. Like, that really just had become my thing. I thought that's where my value was. I had allowed it to define me and to define my worth. And even though I was, like, honor student, this and that, I mean, I had a lot of other accomplishments in life, but that was the one thing that, like, I pressed in on. And when my sisters and my mom and everyone would be like, oh, just wait till you have that first baby and you gain weight. And I thought, well, am I going to be less valuable because I'm going to gain weight? And so I was like, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to fight genetics. Well, genetics are genetics, and you can't fight genetics. Like, you can't manipulate the way your body was created to look and to weigh, and every one of them is different. So for me, I was trying every new fad, new diet, every exercise, anything I could get my hands on, in order to just hold on to that identity, because I was so afraid of losing that identity, because then I was going to lose my value and my worth. So, thankfully, a spiritual mentor in my mid-20s kind of came to me, and we had some conversations, and I started to begin to realize that this was going on in my life. And she really addressed me on it, and I made some behavior changes, which was great. Like, I didn't work out as much. I started eating bad foods, things that I shouldn't, and I felt so free. It was like, cheeseburger, yay, you know? Like, I was so excited, and I started making some behavior changes. But just like with anything, behavior changes don't last long. You know that if it's not a hard change, yeah, with time, it's going to fade. And that's what had happened. And so I was like, oh, shoot, I gotta fix this. And so I pulled my spiritual bootstraps. I'm like, pray more, read my Bible more. I can do this. Get over this, Jonna. Crush this idol. You need to really get over this idol that your body is this and your food is this. Like, get over it. And I felt so helpless. I felt like I can't do this. It didn't matter how many times I prayed Psalm 139. I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, and fearfully and wonderfully made. That's a great verse. I love it. I took it out of context for so long that I'm like, that's not actually what that verse is about, you know? And I would just, I found myself after making all these behavior changes, I gained a little bit of weight because that's what happens when you stop restricting your food for so long. I started making behavior changes. I was trying to spiritually, like, just do this thing. And here I am. I was 37 at the end of my rope. Like, I was at the bottom of a pit. I was so ashamed that I had gained weight. I was so ashamed that I had failed at, of all things, an eating disorder. I felt ashamed that I did not look the way that my husband first saw me. We've been married 21 years. Like, I'm not supposed to look the way I did 21 years ago. But in my mind, I thought, I believe that lie that you can stay the way, that way all your life. You can keep wrinkles away. You can keep cellulite. I believe that. And so here I was at 38, completely in a pit of shame because I had failed. I was a failure at staying thin, and therefore, who am I? And so I really started this identity crisis of, who am I then? If my identity is not thinness, what is it, and who am I? One Sunday, this is a Sunday that Janelle was referring to. It was just over 5 years ago, and our pastor was doing... Our pastor was doing a series sermon on faithfulness, on God's faithfulness. And he had been talking about it, about God being faithful, but I didn't really grasp what that meant for my life. It didn't really hit me until this one specific Sunday. And, I mean, God completely changed my life that day. I had been living in this prison of shame and guilt and fear. Oh, gosh, the fear of gaining weight, the fear of what other people would say about me if I gained weight, the fear of not being the person that others expected me to be or thought I was. I was drowning in that. I had two young kids. I didn't know what to do with this. And so I'm going to read to you this passage that he read. It's just a portion of it, actually. Joshua 3:14-17. So when the people broke camp to cross the Jordan, the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant went ahead of them. Now the Jordan is at flood stage all during harvest. Yet as soon as the priests who carried the Ark reached the Jordan and their feet touched the water's edge, the water from upstream stopped flowing. It piled up in a heap a great distance away at a town called Adam, while the water flowing down to the sea was completely cut off. So the people crossed over opposite Jericho. The priests who carried the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord stood firm on dry ground in the middle of the Jordan while all Israel passed by until the whole nation had completed the crossing on dry ground. So imagine the Israelites. They had been, you know, they've been freed from Egypt, lived in Egypt for 430 years. They freed from that. They get out to the wilderness. God's going to send them to the promised land. The spies say, no, it's a bad place. We're not going to go take the promised land. And then a couple of people are like, well, we're going to go take it on our own. And God's like, sorry, because you tried to go do that on your own, I'm going to send you into the wilderness for 40 years. So here they go into the wilderness for 40 years. They're moving around. They're grumbling. They're complaining. They're having to depend on the Lord and all these things. And this whole time, God has promised them freedom in the promised land. He's promised them milk and honey and this land of bounty. How excited would they be? So excited. So they finally, the day has come. Can you imagine? The day has come and they're like, we're going over today, guys. Let's go. Joshua's leading the charge. He says, okay, guys, get up. You priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant, I want you to get up to the edge of the riverbank. So the riverbank would have been at flood stage at this point, like Scripture is telling us. And so the water, I mean, I don't know what flood stage is. I'm guessing it's pretty high. But you can't even see the promised land. You don't know what's over there. And they're supposed to walk up. And not only do they have to trust Joshua, or don't only have to trust God, but they have to trust Joshua, that they're not going to step in this water and drown. So they get to the edge of the water. And Joshua's like, I just want you to put your feet in. Just step in and believe that God is going to cut the water off and he's going to allow you to cross over and dry ground. So the priests get to the edge of the water. They literally step their feet in. And it says the water on both sides stop from rushing. It becomes dry ground and the whole nation of Israel crosses over. Hundreds of thousands of people cross into this land flowing with milk and honey. And our pastor asked that question. When you think of your life, what is the river that you are so scared to step into? What is it that is so overwhelming and feels like a flood in your life, that you are so scared, but you need to step into that water and trust me. And I sat there and I was like, I knew what it was. I'd been dealing with this idol of image and body hatred and disordered eating for so long. I knew, like, you know when you feel the spirit moving, I was like, I was sweating, I'm crying, I'm shaking. Even the pastor's wife was like, I knew something was going on. You were sitting right behind me. I don't know what's going on. And I sat there and I knew exactly what it was. And it was just at that moment, I was so overwhelmed with this idea of surrender. Because for so long, I had been doing it on my own. I've been pulling up my spiritual bootstraps, trying to pray it away. And that wasn't working. It was like, oh, I will do this. Oh, get rid of this. And that day God said, I need you to trust me. I need you to trust that when you step your feet in that water, I'm going to dry it up. I'm going to make the way. I know you don't know what the promised land looks like. I know you don't know what freedom looks like. I know that you don't know what it's going to be like to cross over. But I can tell you what, I'm going to be there every step of the way. And I'm going to be there to bless you and to help you. And the promised land is so much better than the wilderness. What I have waiting for you on the other side is worth it. Put your dang feet in the water, Jonna. And I sat there so broken. And I was like, what does that mean for me, God? What does that mean? I don't know what that looks like. And I heard him say, that means you're not gonna fear. You're not gonna be afraid. And so I thought, this is the bigger issue. It wasn't just about trying to look a certain way. It wasn't just about having a certain identity. It was about the fear of man. It was about not trusting God. And I thought, okay, it's about fear. It's about, what is it? What is it? I'm afraid of other people and what they're going to think if I gain weight. I'm afraid of what my sisters will say to me. Because I hear them talk about other people and they're going to talk about me. I love my sisters. They're awesome people. But they talk about people when they gain weight. I fear not having value in this world. I fear not having thin privilege. And I was so afraid. But I couldn't not surrender. At that point, God pinpointed it. He knew what it was. He said, I need you to trust me. And I got to in my mind, I'm standing at the edge of the Jordan River. And I'm like, okay, Lord, I have no idea what it's going to look like. I don't know. I don't know what freedom looks like. I've heard it's possible. I want it. I'm going to trust you. I'm going to trust you with no matter what's in my pantry, no matter what I eat. I'm going to trust you if I don't exercise for an hour a day. I'm going to trust you if I gain weight and I have to buy new clothes. Lord, I'm going to trust you because you are faithful. And it doesn't matter what other people say. And it doesn't matter what other people think, because he is the one that matters. I had believed for so long that thinness equals acceptance equals love. Thinness equals acceptance equals love. And I heard God say to me that day, I love you, Jonna. I accept you, Jonna. And it's not because you're thin. It's because I created you. And that is what changed my life. No longer was I working for man. No longer was I going to fight society to try to be who I've been told all these years I was supposed to be. I was finally going to trust the Lord and allow him to be my definition of value and him to be my definition of worth and him to be my identity. And I can't explain it, but I know that that was my day of transformation. That was my day of surrender, of truly understanding what it means to walk in freedom. And I'm not saying it's been easy. Yes, I have gained weight, and I've bought new shorts every freaking summer. And that sucks, but whatever. It hasn't been easy, but I can tell you this. God is worth and so much greater than everything I've had to sacrifice. Everything that he has promised, he is faithful and he is trustworthy. And that's what I want you guys to know. And I want you to be challenged with. I don't know what your fear is. Maybe it's not this. But maybe you have a fear of sickness. Maybe you have a fear of your husband leaving you. Maybe you have a fear of not being important in this world. Maybe you're full of shame. What is your shame? Probably goes back to childhood. Probably something that you were told that you believed about yourself at some point. But I want you to think about, what is your fear? What is your shame? What's holding you back from experiencing the bounty that God has for you in the promised land? And I want to challenge you to get up to that river and to say, Lord, I am going to trust you because I'm accepted by you. It doesn't matter if anyone else accepts me. I'm loved by you. It doesn't matter if no one else ever pays any attention to me, tells me I'm important, tells me thank you, nothing. God, because you love me and you accept me, I'm going to put my feet in this water. I'm going to trust you're going to separate it, and I'm going to walk across on dry ground. And I promise you, because Scripture promises you, that on the other side, you will experience a freedom that I cannot explain. I am a different person than I was 5 years ago. I can live without the chains. I can live outside of this prison that I had been living in for so long. And so I want to encourage you guys. If you feel like you're in this spot, find out the truth. Find out about who God is, because that is where your hope should be. Not in the thing you fear, not in the place you have shame. He is to be your hope. And when he is your hope, you can walk in freedom. So I challenge you to do that. Consider it. Consider the truth, the hope, and the freedom that only Jesus can bring. I'm going to close this in prayer, and then we have a little bit of time for Q&A. Will you pray with me? God, you are our freedom. You are our deliverer. You take us from a place of wilderness and shame and guilt, of chains, especially regarding diet culture, especially regarding our bodies, how we feel about ourselves, what we view about ourselves. God, you take us from that place and you move us into a place of freedom. God, you want that for us. You want it for these ladies. And I just ask that you will deliver them today. Whatever it is that's gnawing at them, if they feel the moving of the Spirit, God, that they would not reject it. They would not sit still. But God, that they would go and they would be curious and they would investigate. They would find out who you are, God, the truth about you. God, that you would be their hope. And that you would help them to walk in freedom on dry ground to the promised land that you have for them. Jesus, we love you. We thank you for salvation. We thank you that we can walk in your grace and in your truth. In Jesus' name, amen.
Thanks, Jenna.
You're welcome. Do we have some time for Q&A?
Anyone have any questions
or for Jenna? Yeah,
Angela. This is not the same thing you're talking about, but I'm wondering if you have any words of wisdom for someone who's me or like me, which is that I stress eat. Like if I'm trying to figure out something that's hard or work on something that's hard, obviously as life has gone on, I have less of those circumstances. Like college was like, it could have even been something healthy, but I would just stress eat, which are physically calories my body wasn't asking for. And then on a spiritual level, I am literally trying to find something to comfort me in that moment. And this has also been something, like you're saying, I try to pull up my spiritual bootstraps and try to at sometimes tackle and sometimes I don't. And I just don't know if you have any like words of wisdom for someone like me who, that's what I would say my downfall is with food.
Yeah, I think that that is a valid, stress eating is a thing. I mean, people do it. And it's just something that you have learned to rely on as a coping mechanism. And so I'm not a stress eater, but I listen to enough podcasts where they talk about stress eating, kind of funny, that I've just picked up tips from them on stress eating and the fact that it just is a coping mechanism. So trying to, whatever it is, like whatever your coping mechanism is, trying to identify what's actually going on at the moment, you're like, yeah, I'm stressed. I have so much going on. Okay, but there's a deeper feeling below that, like always trying to dig a little deeper. So is this stress being caused by I have to get this to-do list done, because if I don't, then fill in the blank, well then what if that happens, well then blah blah blah. And so getting to the actual root, maybe it's like you don't want to let your friends down because then they're going to think less of you, or you don't want your husband to be mad at you, or whatever's causing the stress, trying to get to the root of that is what I would say. And then in that, trying to figure out a different coping mechanism that wouldn't include eating. So it could just be a walk, or it could be some breathing techniques, or listening to some music or something.
Smoking.
Up for it. Just know that, like, I just did it. I'm moving on. You know, don't let it affect the rest of your day or like what.
Identify with that part of the cycle that you talk about. Like, oh, I failed last time. I'm gonna get it next time.
Yeah.
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
It feels so
smoking
breathless.
Is bad.
But it feels so reckless what you're saying. You know what I mean? Like, you're like just. I was so excited. I was just like, I could finally have a cheeseburger and all these things. And so I'm
that's
like, well, where is the line of, I don't have to eat all organic. I can, you know, where is the line of eating healthy and having that healthy relationship with food and also not eating food that's just
bad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like a cigarette.
Or for
that's
Oreos.
Or,
you know,
or eating for emotional reasons, too.
Yeah.
Like, what I would say my struggle would be is non-physical cues. You know, eating for non-physical cues is not godly either, obviously, or is not a healthy relationship.
Yeah, because
right. There's
like that other end of the spectrum where, because that's what I was thinking of different instances where it's like, well, I'm hungry, so I can eat that. And it's like, that's not always the right answer. You know, you don't have a piece of pizza on the way to getting Qdoba with your friend. Like, that's a different, like,
right.
I saw that happen.
Yeah.
You know, that's not always the right
thing either. To kind of expand on that is a total accurate feeling or thought to have. I felt that way when I first started this recovery journey, because you don't know. Like, for so long, you've been told, this is it. Stay in the box. Anything out of it is reckless, right?
Yeah.
You're irresponsible if you're eating those things. And there was a time where you're like, I can eat anything. So you go to this end of the spectrum, and you just kind of like... But like I said, it balances out. It's kind of like a pendulum to where it just kind of comes back to the middle, and... Like, now I've just kind of found myself in this middle ground. I can't explain how it happens, but I can say that when it's new thoughts, it's hard to even grasp. Like, I would not expect you to be able to even understand that that's possible to be in this middle where you're not all or nothing. But it is. And that's where I think this book is super helpful, because it kind of explains that whole idea of when food loses its power. It's like, I love Oreos, but like, I don't crave them, and we can even have them in the cabinet and I can pass by them because it doesn't have that power anymore. But when you're first starting that journey of trying to figure some of this stuff out and challenging that thinking, it is hard to imagine life without these rules. I do think that we have to challenge the idea of what healthy actually is too, because it, you know, that definition is really kind of watery and fluid because of what, you know, society tells us. Like, some people think healthy is all organic, all real foods, and some people would say not. And so it's just this, that's all stuff. I don't get any commission. I recommend it. So, yeah, it's possible to get there. It just takes time. Did you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say on that was, like, even if you go to the doctor, like, if you have, like, I have higher bone density, so I am always going to be on the obese side of, like, their charts, right?
That's crazy.
Because of the percentages. So it's like, you get their thing at the bottom, and it says you're in the obese, and then how do you deal with that, right? Like,
yeah.
Feel like,
they have just shamed you for the
so
way that your body was
so
created.
I never want to go to the
doctor.
I almost don't
go to the doctor because I think they're like, I see a pain. Exactly. I'll
like plan my outfit,
like
what shoes can I take off,
what
layers can I take off.
Yeah.
Get on their
shoes
because I hate it so much.
Some practical tips of advice for that is don't look at the doctor when you get on the scale. You can even ask not to be weighed. Some doctors will honor that. But do what we call a blind weigh, where you just close your eyes or turn around and then you don't look at the paper. But on that same note, so I don't know if you guys know this, but the BMI, the body mass index, is actually a junk science.
Yeah.
There's no validity to it. It was created on by a physicist or something that a math equation. It's a math equation that doctors will use to tell you that you're obese. And all it does is shame people. And so don't put that on your kids. Don't put it on you. Like, if your doctor tries to tell you, well, your BMI is high, you know, you really should go on a diet, don't listen to them. They don't know your lifestyle. They're basing it on a math equation. And what's interesting is the medical community will take the thing that they will tell a larger person to do to lose weight is the same exact set of habits that a person with an eating disorder will do naturally. So it's like a doctor is a proponent of these really disordered eating habits for someone just because they're in a larger body, and yet it's killing the smaller body that's doing it on purpose. And it makes no sense. It's like the medical community, I don't think they know it. I don't know if they realize it. So I would encourage you to find doctors that...
Yeah. I was just going to say, you don't... Mm-hmm. I read a book that said, in med school, doctors go to one nutrition class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One. They don't... That's not their job.
Right.
Their job is to fix what you came in for,
right.
Not
right.
to tell you. So if you want to know about nutrition,
yeah.
you go to a nutritionist or a dietitian that's been trained to work with you on nutrition and diet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Don't
and
listen to the doctor... They don't know. I mean,
right.
that's not their training.
Right. Mm-hmm.
There
are intuitive eating
really
nutritionists, too.
Yes.
I agree. But I'm just saying, they've at least had some training
yes.
and
right.
classes, whereas
right.
doctors have not.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you just have to really be careful with that. A lot
right.
of doctors don't, they're not.
And they will
they
say
know.
That the cure to any health problem is going to be to lose weight. Like,
yes.
Honestly,
yeah.
that's what they will
yeah.
say. I do want to say, too, something Janelle touched on is, if for some reason you do find yourself wanting to find a dietitian, I would be really diligent about finding one who is, they're registered dietitians with a, either like intuitive eating or they call it health at every size, food freedom kind of specialty. And I have a lot of them. I'm kind of in that world and have some resources that I can send you names in this area because most nutritionists, dietitians, go to school to learn how to help people lose weight. And so that's their goal. They'll give you a meal plan where you're going to eat less.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a dietitian who is all about intuitive eating, that's not their goal. Their goal is to help you to be healthy, to find health at whatever size
mm-hmm.
you're at, not to lose weight.
In that intuitive eating, do they talk about, like, if our kids say they're hungry, you know, are we supposed to be feeding them when they're hungry? Or is it based around
yes.
three meals and we are supposed to be, hey, we're just about to eat, you know. And obviously, Oreos, I think we can all agree, I mean, there's a point where Oreos are unhealthy. They weren't in the garden. But what's interesting to what Christy said is my kids, when we would go to visit cousins, and she would have snacks and M&M's out all the time. I mean, my kids were like savages
yeah.
around M&M's, and her kids were not.
Because they were sitting out all the time.
Because
yeah.
that's just how she raised
yeah.
them, was with the M&M's out. And you should have
yeah.
seen my kids. We were in the car like, you cannot inhale all their M&M's, and it's because, you know, they were
forbidden.
So, right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I know that is
yeah.
true,
yeah.
that they...
Yeah.
Did
you want what
despite
you
me saying
have,
that I'm just saying
you
I'm still
yet.
Have.
Yet.
So
yeah.
what does
yeah.
the mom do? She puts out more M&M's and I'm like, they will eat.
Right.
Well, look, they're empty.
Yeah. And then they go home saying, Mom, why don't we have M&M's?
Right.
Why
don't
yeah.
right. So I know that there is a point where her kids weren't doing it. They were actually
because it was just M&M's.
Right.
It wasn't.
So what about feeding our kids when they're hungry?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question. I think that's going to be obviously a circumstantial situation. If it's, you know, 15 minutes before dinner and they're getting in the pantry getting stuff, just, you know, having them hold on and wait. But if they're coming home from school and they're, like, so hungry that they want a full meal, feed them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think it's fair for us to tell them if they're hungry or not. Again, the situation, maybe they are stressed. Maybe they are emotional. Maybe they're bored. So kind of picking that apart and finding out, oh, where are they? Are they actually hungry or are they just bored? Something like that, which is hard to figure that out in kids, right?
Unless they're boys, then they're just always
hungry. Right, and I was going to say, I mean, I think we put on our kids the food rules that we've grown up with. And so, like, oh, I didn't think we were allowed to eat past 7. I didn't think you were supposed to come home from school and eat anything more than a cheese stick. Like, so I think you need to teach your kids to honor their hunger cues. If it doesn't look like what you think it should look like or what society says it look like, that's okay. They may, if they have a big, huge snack at 3 o'clock after school, they may eat less for dinner, and that's okay. Like, don't force them. The whole Clean Plate Club is crock. So a lot of the people that kind of I follow and stuff, they're always talking about eating dessert with your dinner.
Mm-hmm.
Like, don't save it. It's not supposed to have this, like, halo around it. It's just part of the meal. It's just food. Just put it on the table and serve it.
I just want to add
dessert first.
Okay. Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I just wanted to add one thing that's helpful, like, because I've worked in a hospital for many years. So I totally agree with Jill. Like, don't ask. The physician is not the person, the weight loss person. But don't feel too bad about these little markers about obesity. While these equations are somewhat flawed and come historically, the problem is, for many years, when they've collected data to see who's at risk for what, they have used that marker. So even if these day and age body types are different, maybe things should be edited, we can't go back and get that same information. Does that make sense? So, like, if you have diabetes and you're considered obese, you're more at risk for heart problems or something like that. They have that data, and they need to think about that to care for you properly.
Mm-hmm.
Also, some medications are dose-based, and also some equations where they're looking at kidney function or something like that are weight-based.
Mm-hmm.
So practically speaking, they do need to have a weight that makes sense on file for you in order to interpret you well and to care for you. And you may just have to think, I am of healthy weight.
Yeah.
I take care of myself,
yeah.
I exercise,
yeah.
and I'm going to ignore that it says that and know that
yeah.
it means something a little different to the doctor. It does not mean in their head, like often I've been with physicians who they'll say, yep, yeah, you look great. Like they're just looking at someone and they're ignoring those numbers. So don't, no physician's going to think you're obese, is my point. Even if it says on a piece of paper, they're like, she's not obese.
Nor are any people.
Right.
So then my challenge on that is why would it matter if someone did call you obese?
Right.
Like
right.
Yeah.
So my kids, we didn't talk about weight and things like that. So when they were younger, they still kind of do. They just think fat is a descriptor.
That's awesome.
They don't. And so but then like I was really sad when they got to the age where I was like, but you don't just want to tell people they're fat. Because some people have really bad feelings about that.
That's great, though, that that's their...
But, like, I know you're not really necessarily... You're just like, oh, that person's fatter.
Right.
So, it's just a descriptor.
It is
it's
just a descriptor. It's not a bad word.
It'll be like,
Bob,
your belly's fat. Well, I've had 5 of you, so...
Thank
you. You know what's interesting? When Jada Pinkett Smith... She went through this thing where she was like, she doesn't allow the word fat in her house. And I remember thinking, because she didn't want her kids to use it as a descriptor, and I remember thinking, I don't know how I feel about that. Because some people do, most Americans have a negative connotation with the word.
Right.
And so that's why she banned it. She didn't want her kids to hurt other people's feelings, which is good. Be conscientious of the words you use when you're around others.
Yeah.
Right.
But at the same time, it also put a lot of weight into the word.
Yeah.
A lot of meaning into it that she was trying to avoid. But then by telling them it wasn't allowed, it's kind of like the food forbidden thing. Yeah. It's forbidden, and now it makes it even worse.
And is it like Oreos? So they're going fat, 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 fat.
Well, and there's a point where you, I mean, you have fat.
Well, they probably have nutrition.
Well, there's a difference between you have fat and you are fat. Like, one is obviously an identity issue. And we also have bones and we have muscles.
Yeah.
Like, it's just...
Right.
Like,
and our largest organs.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, there, that, the key is that identity.
But the whole idea behind it is very cultural.
Yeah, it's the whole fat phobia.
Yeah,
right,
moving
yeah.
to the Philippines where...
That's going to say if you live somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like, it was a compliment when people would come
For
up to
sure.
me and say, oh, you look so fat.
Yeah.
And it was like, okay, I'm American. Let's step back here for a second. But it was, like, a real challenge
for
to
sure.
that thought of... To them, it meant I had enough money to actually feed my body the way it needed to be fed. It didn't mean, oh, you've gained a lot of weight that you didn't need to gain. You know, there was a definite different... It's very cultural.
Well, and that
yeah,
was the American culture, even. It was part of our culture
Absolutely.
Before.
Yeah.
The 1900s.
Standards of beauty
yeah.
always follow
yeah,
the
money.
Yeah.
Oh,
that means
money.
You're wealthy.
I know, we need to
talk
about
yeah.
that doing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to tell you about this other book, too. It's called Life Inside the Thin Cage. And I gave you guys a list of resources. So the lady, this book was really good, too, because it's kind of, it's like for people, the normal people that are like, oh, I have an eating disorder, but you live inside this pursuit of thinness and the side of this cage. So Constance, she is the founder of a ministry called Finding Balance. And Finding Balance is an online Christian community for people with disordered eating and body shame. And that is what, after God set me free that day, through a series of God events, I ended up with Finding Balance and part of that ministry and got to be a part of an online small group. And they take it, I mean, it always comes back to God's truth and who, where you place your identity and where you find your value. And so follow Finding Balance. They have daily emails that you can get with a little verse and a little kind of devotional. She's great. The whole ministry is great. So I highly recommended that. And I gave you some podcasts and books and verses and all that.
And